Hey, good afternoon, Juneau, on a kind of a foggy and a drizzly afternoon. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. This is Pat Moore, and we're going to do Juneau Afternoon right now. I have a great lineup of guests for us. Boston Christopher and Alicia Jones are standing by. They're going to bring us information about the world premiere of Rush Everlasting, which opens up very shortly out at Perseverance Theater. Pete Griffin's going to come by. He's got a new CD out, storyteller, Well, he used to be a ranger, and he's sort of changed his occupation, and now he's doing storytelling full-time. Ben Huff's going to come by, tell us about a photo class he's offering, and Andy Klein's going to drop by to tell us about the three new beers that are going to be released by the Alaska Brewing Company. So all that's going to happen on Juneau Afternoon today. Stay tuned right now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Gonzalez. Forecasters say South Dakota and North Dakota residents should prepare for some of the coldest air in more than a decade. This weekend, several reservations will be hit with a cold front. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Most of North Dakota has spent today under a blizzard warning. That cold air and strong wind is moving south and will plummet temperatures on the plains overnight. Kelly Sayre with the National Weather Service in Aberdeen says it's a dangerous situation.
That is correct, yes. After that cold front comes through tonight, all we're going to see is falling temperatures through the weekend and into next week. Really, we're going to have wind chill values dropping below 30 below zero wind chills Saturday night, and they're going to continue into early next week. Right now, it's still looking like the coldest wind chill values will be Sunday night into Monday morning, where we could see wind chills dropping into the 50 below zero range.
Sisseton and Wahpeton and tribal lands in South Dakota are part of a winter weather advisory for today. Roughly the northern half of the state has a winter weather advisory taking effect tonight. That advisory area includes the Standing Rock and Cheyenne River reservations in South Dakota. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
Members of the Native Alliance in Duluth, Minnesota recently gathered to mark the transition to the new year. J.P. Rehnquist from WGZS has more.
It's known as Indaben Bimatazi, which organizers translate roughly as a new day or a new life. Indaben Bimatazi uses the Anishinaabe tradition of storytelling to mark the transition of one year to the next, both in the telling of traditional Wenabuju stories and through more personal sharing. Babette Sandman works as an Anishinaabe cultural liaison at AJC, a regional youth correction center. She's also a volunteer with the Duluth Native Alliance.
It's refreshing for people, this transition into 2014, that it can signify a new day. At AJC, we talk about that every day. We talk about Wabanoon from the east direction. It brings a new day from the east direction.
The Native Alliance began in early 2013. Organizers say that in some ways it is an offshoot of the Idle No More movement. Native Alliance works for social change one person, one family at a time. Anthony Hernandez, who is Lakota and a member of Native Alliance, struggled with addiction but turned his own life around. He says stories are an important part of marking the transition to a new year.
Is it remembering what you've accomplished this past year and the struggles that you've had this past year and learning from those and moving into a new day or a new beginning or the new year with a positive outlook and using what you've learned from the past year to move forward in a more positive way?
Hernandez says that he hopes that the Native Alliance will continue to grow in 2014 and eventually to expand its services to people of all races and cultural backgrounds. For National Native News, I'm J.P. Rehnquist in Duluth, Minnesota.
Native activist Carter Camp has died. According to the Associated Press, a family member says the 72-year-old passed away in Oklahoma last week after battling cancer. Camp was a member of the American Indian Movement and a leader during the occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota in the 1970s. Services were held this week. In Wisconsin, funeral services are being held today for Native comedian Charlie Hill. The 62-year-old passed away Monday after battling cancer. He was a Native pioneer on the Hollywood scene, from stand-up comedy to writing and acting on television shows. He used humor to address Native American stereotypes. His decades-long career included appearances on The Richard Pryor Show and The Tonight Show. In January 1987, this program went on the air from Anchorage, Alaska. National Native News is now produced in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and heard on tribal and public radio stations across the U.S. and Canada. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Kawanic Broadcast Corporation is accepting art for the Alaska Native Art Auction, February 20th, 2014 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event to buy art. Proceeds benefit National Native News. Learn more at knba.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Pat Moore. I'm the host today for Juneau Afternoon. It's my great pleasure right now to be talking to Boston Christopher, who is directing Arlisha Jones's, world debut of a new play called Rush Everlasting. And they're both here in the studio with us, and we get to talk about the play for a few minutes. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's Rush at Everlasting.
Rush at Everlasting. Anyway, so it opens up, January 10th, but you've got, you're playing a pay-as-you-go.
We have a couple of pay-as-you-can previews this Sunday at 7:30 and next Wednesday at 7:30 before we officially open next Friday at 7:30. Imagine that. All the evening show times are at 7:30. But yeah, that's when we open on January 10th and we run through February 2nd.
Yeah, so a number of opportunities, but of course, as always, you want to get in fairly early because the houses can fill up on your place.
Without
much trouble at all. Anyway, so that Rush at Everlasting is, it has echoes of a couple of films that a lot of people are familiar with, because basically it's about two characters who decide to commit a crime.
Right,
and,
two women
and go from there. So I guess the question which everybody kind of thinks about is, so how much of Bonnie and Clyde and Thelma and Louise were in your head when you were starting to write this thing?
A lot of Bonnie and Clyde were in my head. I'd done my research and read a few books on them, and of course I'd seen the movie, the Bonnie and Clyde movie, which is going to be showing at the Gold Town this Saturday, I believe. In conjunction with the play. So that was in my head quite a bit, and that whole story and the time, the Great Depression, and it's just, you know, it's really gripping when you start to read it. Thelma and Louise, and it's funny you make that connection, was not in my head at all. I've seen that movie one time quite a while ago. The movie that was in my head that I've been obsessed with since I was a little girl, and I saw it when it came out in the movie theaters, was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
And I think what I realized one day was, I think I've feminized the Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid myth in that.
Now, one of the things that you did, if I understand, I'm going off blurb here because I've never seen it. I haven't sat in rehearsals or anything. Nobody's seen it except you in Boston and people in the play.
Right.
So there's a point in there, there's a conversation in there in the blurb about the fact that the women are kind of disconnected from what they're doing. They're thinking not about the world that they're in the middle of, but about the things they're going to do with the money.
Yeah, one of them is thinking about what she wants to do with the money and the dream, but it's not really about the money. It's about that, what do we do with our lives when we're stuck in this mundane, crushing world that has just taken everything from us in the Great Depression. I mean, they're worried about where their next meal is coming from sometimes. And just that idea that your name is going to be remembered, or you're going to do something exciting or something completely unpredictable. And I mean, that's certainly modern times, too. We all kind of face that.
It didn't have nearly as strong an effect in Alaska, but the United States and the rest of the world have kind of just come through a period of near depression. Mm-hmm. We came dangerously close to doing some really devastating things to the world economy.
Right.
How much of that was, in other words, how much did that rush your timing?
I had started the play before that, and then as those events started to occur, and even here in Alaska, whether or not we lost, you know, our luxuries or even our food, but there was this fear that was so palpable in all of us that sort of came in, and then just that sort of shutting down your life. You didn't go out and do things. You just sat at home. And whether you had the money or not, because you were just so afraid. So I think that it really did. And that's when I think the
first public reading was 2009, 2008. First public reading was around that time, so it really was resonant.
Yeah, I think there's, I was just looking here, October, oh, let's see. I can look it up. Anyway.
It's hard for me to know what year, I think, because once I start the play, it's all started, 1 year. Yeah. Whether it's 10 years or 1 year. Yeah.
I'm more familiar with writing prose.
Right.
When you're writing a play, the process that most prose writers have to do is they immerse themselves in the story to the point where you actually lose yourself. You don't have any connection to the outside world while you're writing. And then you look up and you realize that you just put 20 pages to bed.
Right.
The same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I can be writing in my plays. I have another play. When the play came to me, it just sort of possessed me. And I was at work, actually, and I went in, and there was no work being done that day. So I just sat and wrote my play. And when I finally looked up, there was a stapler on the desk, and I didn't know the word for stapler. I didn't know why a stapler was there next to me, because I was out on the tundra. So very much the same thing. And for me as a playwright, I write visually. I see my plays a long time before I ever hear any dialogue, so I'll see things. And what's so great about working with Boston is he makes these pictures then on stage and brings the significance and the meaning to what's on the page in black and white. He's like, he can see what I saw in my head.
So, Boston, you're sitting on the other side of the stage now. Mm-hmm. Normally, you're up there and you're being directed, but now you're in the chair with the director on the back of it, but they don't give you a chair at Prince Mary's. Anyway, so tell us a little bit on that experience.
Well, I think there's it's a great duality to be an actor and a director, and I've been doing both now for a number of years, and I love going back and forth because each informs the other. As an actor, your job is to be inside what I would think of as the piece of art. You have your role and you have your contribution to the overall story and the arc of that story. And then as the director, and especially a director on a new play, and I've worked with Arlisha before on a new play, and we've just been great friends forever, but I really think that your job as a director on a new play is to manifest the vision of the playwright and to take that vision and put it into motion. And Arlisha has a background as a poet, and I really sort of think of her work as poetry in motion. So it's about how do you find that feeling, that mood, that atmosphere, that kind of connection to the material. And then when you find it, how do you then manifest it on stage? And that's a great journey to take as a director. And then when you go back to acting, you understand story even better, and your part in playing that role in a play is also more enriched because you've been a director.
I'm curious about process here.
Mm-hmm.
You said that basically you're bringing the vision to the stage. So you've got this piece of paper in front of you that she's handed you, and it's got the play on it, or this stack of paper, and you're reading through it. Are you, at that point, are you starting to see, or do you have to wait until you've actually got a stage in front of you and you've got people to move around?
No, you visualize. You visualize as you read, and you see images in your story, in your head, just as you would maybe in a book. In a play, there's usually more dialogue and less of the visual explanation, depending upon the playwright. And then once you get your team of designers, and we have it's the other thing we haven't mentioned yet is that this is Arlisha's an Alaskan, and that she lives here in Alaska, and that this is an Alaskan playwright writing stories, which I think is fantastic. And we have an all-Alaskan design team.
Mm-hmm.
Art Roach is doing the set. Lucy Peckham's doing the sound. Lauren Miller, who did Raisin in the Sun and The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry, is doing the lights. And Val Snyder, who costume designed 39 Steps with me, is also on this. So it's been a real pleasure to work with them and bring this world together. And as we learn more about the play, Arlisha and I have been with this play for a number of years, before Perseverance even decided to do it. We've done some readings at other places and just been thinking about this play for a long time. So that helps as well, sort of the time invested and the visual references and metaphors that are created by Arlisha's words. Then it's like, the process of bridging that gap to movement, you know, and what is that, and what does that look like in a theatrical setting, not in a film setting, not in a novel setting, but in a theatrical setting? What does that look like? And there's a lot of freedom in the theater to create those kind of images.
Mm-hmm.
freedom, but also risk.
Oh, yeah.
In the sense that when you two are talking about trying to create a world on the stage, and if it doesn't work, and how are you going to know until tomorrow night or Sunday night?
Well, that, I think you learn through this, and it's one of the great things about play production in this country is that people are starting to get more value out of second and third productions. So this is the first production of this play. We will have a short, brief intermission before we then go to Anchorage and perform the play again in Arlisha's mm-hmm. hometown. So we will be informed by the 4 weeks that we perform here in Juneau, and we'll go back. We won't have a lot of time, but we'll be able to make some minor adjustments as we go into Anchorage. And anytime you're creating a new piece of material, a new living, because there's a play as a piece of literature, right? It's on the page and you can reference it. But then when you get into the theater and it becomes a performance, what is that and how do you bridge that? And that is the, that's the sort of the fun, that's the creativity, that's the challenge.
I think the freedom too is for any artistic endeavor and any artist, that's at the core of what we do. Every time I can't tell you how many times I sat down to write this play and start it and failed and failed and failed and failed. And you just keep, it's like a faith that you have that just go in it with an open heart and keep trying. And if you do your absolute best and you tell the truth that you know, it's going to work eventually. You know, maybe this isn't it, maybe it is. But I will say that at working with Boston before on a project and now, every night when I walk into the theater and I see what's happening with what I put on the page, it's getting bigger, so much bigger than what I came to them with, this little, 89 pages of type for them. So that's part of that freedom. And if we didn't have that freedom and trust, it wouldn't happen at all.
Great opportunity to see a world premiere of the play right here in Juneau. And the times again and the days are?
Absolutely. We open on January 10th. We have a couple of previews before that on this Sunday and next Wednesday. All evening performances are at 7:30 p.m. There's a final matinee on February 2nd at 2 p.m. And, of course, you can go to perseverancetheater.org and get more information or call us at 463-TIXS and order some tickets. You can also get them at the bookstores and all the various normal locations, the Jack and everything. And it's an all Alaskan play, and it's really great for Perseverance to be supporting this kind of writer and this kind of structure in this kind of way. So,
Boston Christopher, Alaisha Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the world premiere. We're all looking forward to seeing it.
Thank you, Pat.
Today is actually the 55th anniversary of statehood for the state of Alaska. And so in honor of that, here's the song. Alaska's flag in honor of the fact that this is the 55th anniversary of statehood. Back in 1959, they signed the paper and made us a state. Son of a gun. That's a while, isn't it? Anyway, my next guest, I don't know if were you here? You were here about 20 years ago, I think, right?
I arrived in Juneau in 1999.
99, okay. Yeah. So you weren't here in 59.
No, I wasn't. I was a long ways away.
Yeah. Where were you? Just out of curiosity.
Growing up in Michigan.
Growing up in Michigan. Okay. The voice you're hearing is Pete Griffin, who is a storyteller. Pete started out in the way that all storytellers do as a district ranger for the... Anyway, so interesting transition. You were called the voice of the Tongass for a good while, though. So you started this while you were doing your day job, right?
Yes, I did. I actually got roped into doing some essays on the radio down in Ketchikan in 1998 and 1999. And when I transferred to Juneau as the district ranger in 99, the folks at the radio station down there said, "Well, you ought to take this essay to Juneau." I thought, "Oh gosh, you know the." The folks in Juneau are a little bit more sophisticated than the people in Ketchikan, and you know, who would want some kind of country bumpkin telling natural history stories on the radio in Juneau? But I did it. I did it for several years, and folks have kind of learned to associate my voice with the Tongass National Forest.
And out of that voice came the fact that you really started liking to tell stories. So you actually went and trained.
I did. In some respects, I grew to know that my stories were interesting and folks enjoyed them, but I wanted to hone my craft a little bit more. So I joined the National Storytelling Network, attended a lot of conferences and workshops, and grew a little more comfortable in telling stories and actually standing in front of strangers and telling stories.
So now you've graduated into the world of marketing and et cetera. You've got a CD out that we can actually buy and listen to.
I do. The Skunk Whisperer is the title.
Great
it's the title story. It comes from
an
experience I had in the Forest Service back on the Chippewa National Forest. I was a young supervisor, and I got up on my soapbox one day and said we weren't going to kill any more skunks in our campgrounds. We were going to live trap them and release them. And my employee said, Can you do that? Have you ever done that before, Pete? And I said, no, but I know it can be done. So the first time they live trapped a skunk, they called me. And I realized that was one of those moments where either I had to back it up with action.
Uh-huh.
So the Skunk Whisperer is the story of me and that skunk and the live release.
Which, Jeff, take a bath afterward.
I will.
We'll let them
learn the outcome of that.
So the other stories on here are "You'll Never Take Me Alive."
Yes, a story about my mother's reaction to a warrant that was going to be issued for her arrest because of a parking ticket my car had that went unpaid for several months.
Shrews.
That's. I've always been fascinated with these little shrews. I see them out in the woods all the time while hunting, and they are little animals that have to eat their weight in food every day or they die. And they're so tiny, and it's something I tell the kids because they really enjoy that, and they'll show a picture of shrews. And there's actually the pygmy shrew, which if it goes without eating for 3 hours, it dies of starvation. So fascinating little animals.
Talks with wolves.
Oh, that's another story from my Forest Service career as a wildlife biologist. And it was an experience that I had that it raised the hair on the back of my neck. It was a terrific experience.
Dave?
Dave was a friend of my dad's as they grew up as teenagers. They did a lot of hunting and fishing together. And my dad came from a pretty poor family, and Dave was the guy down the road, a member of the Chippewa tribe. And it was an unlikely friendship, and I learned so much from Dave over the years, watching him and seeing how he conducted himself and how he never panicked in situations where other folks might panic.
And finally, on the CD, not finally, for our conversation, because we'll come back after we have a chance to actually hear you in action, here is "Till Death Do Us Part." Let's listen.
I was in Phoenix several years ago, riding on a shuttle bus between the hotel and the airport when something caught my eye. A billboard. Now, I'm not a big fan of billboards, but this one caused me to sit up and take notice. It had those universal male and female symbols, you know the ones, a circle with an arrow for a male, a circle with a cross for a female. There are astrological signs for Mars and Venus, and there was a jagged red lightning bolt dividing the two. It was an advertisement for an internet company specializing in divorce, and you could get one for the low, low price of $395. Oh my goodness, I thought. Is there anything you can't get on the internet? But that billboard got me to thinking. There are a number of wildlife species that are known to mate for life, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, till death do they part. People usually think of geese and swans. Wolves might come to mind as well, although the alpha male and alpha female pair up through competition with other wolves in the pack. Their status as the one mated pair in the pack can change depending on circumstances. I tend to think of wolves as having an arrangement, like a marriage of convenience that lasts only as long as both parties agree it's to their advantage to remain together. Bald eagles, on the other hand, do mate for life, returning to their territory every year to start over. In late winter, each pair initiates a courtship ritual that begins the mating season. The two of them do a complex aerial dance, circling high in the sky and then plunging earthward, tumbling, locking claws with each other, swooping and circling, tumbling together again until they pull out, usually but not always, well above the ground. They select one of the nests in their territory and remodel it with new sticks. Back east, we saw that the male often brought the female a fresh evergreen bough while she was on the nest. Now, I suppose the romantics among us might say that that's the eagle equivalent of flowers or a heart-shaped box of chocolate candy. Nobody ever figured out exactly what the green branch was for, and maybe we really don't need to know in order to appreciate eagles. I remember watching a pair of eagles early in my Forest Service career as a wildlife biologist in Michigan. It was the only pair of eagles in my district of 150,000 acres. We'd begun monitoring the nest in the early 1960s, and up through the late 1970s, the pair had failed to produce young. Most of the time, there was no egg in the nest. The few times we did see an egg, it was crushed beneath the weight of the adult, the effects of an environment laced with lingering traces of DDT and other chemicals. But in the 1980s, that changed. One year there was an egg, and it remained unbroken for the whole incubation period. We watched closely, but from a distance, until finally it hatched, a beautiful young eaglet. It was carefully tended by the adults until the young bird fledged and left the nest. So what had happened? Had these eagles finally rid themselves of the accumulations of pesticides in their systems? Well, no. We came to realize that one of the eagles was a new mate. How did we know? Well, one of the birds wore a shiny aluminum leg band, and somewhere along the line, the original female of the pair died during the winter. Till death do us part. The surviving male hadn't pined away. It found a new mate, a female that was likely banded as a nestling. She had come of age in a world with fewer pesticides in the food chain, and as a result, could lay healthy eggs. When we endow wild creatures with human emotions, it's called anthropomorphism. As a wildlife biologist, I learned that it isn't good to do that. Under the cold, clinical eye of science, everything wild animals do is because of a basic need to survive and pass along their genes to a new generation. They don't experience gratitude, hatred, or love. I know that is a matter of science, but I can't help feeling that human beings might benefit from a look at the eagle and the rituals each pair goes through every spring to renew their lifelong bonds, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, till death do us part.
Till death do us part.
I grew up in Cedarville, a small town in upper Michigan.
Well, let's not listen to it twice. A story in the true history of stories. You've got a gift for being able to tell a tale and have it kind of come alive in front of us.
Well, thank you. I think a lot of folks actually have that gift if they would practice it, if they would craft it, if they would polish it up a little bit.
And I guess one of the questions I want to ask as we close the interview here is, how do you find the opportunities to do that? I mean, I talk to my kids, but that's a far cry from to the point where you actually are creating a CD and putting it out where people can sit and listen to the story again and again. So how do you find the opportunities?
Well, when I worked for the Forest Service, I had a captive audience. My employees had to listen to me. But I really look all over for opportunities. So there's opportunities at the library. There are opportunities to go back to the office where I retired from and tell an occasional story. There are other opportunities. Mudrooms is an opportunity. I've told stories in Honolulu, Hawaii, Richmond, Virginia, back where I grew up, L.A., there are all kinds of venues to offer a person a place to share their stories.
So I guess you just have to open up and be sensitive to the opportunities that exist.
Absolutely. That's the big thing. I've been a person who has not always taken advantage of opportunities because I sit back and go, should I do this or should I not? You always ought to. You always ought to open that door that's offered to you and step through it and walk into a new life.
Son of a gun. Good advice. Maybe some of our listeners will find their inner storyteller and give you a little competition in the field here. Can you handle a competition?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, thank you so much. CD is The Skunk Whisperer. It's by Pete Griffin. Pete, where can people find this?
It's available for sale down at the Jack from my website, thestorytellingranger.com, and through Road Candy Records.
Outstanding. Okay, so if the tale that we told, which was Till Death Do Us Part, it got your attention, then there's five more cuts on the CD, and then there's the opportunity to find our guest, Pete Griffin, somewhere at one of the many venues where he tells stories and get another taste. Thank you so much for coming down and talking to us.
Thank you.
I'm traveling singer-songwriter Marion Call. Join me for the next concert in the KRNN Spotlight Series on January 8th at 7 p.m. in the Goldtown Nickelodeon. I'll be singing my original acoustic songs about life on the road and home in Alaska. Most songs will be from my brand new album, Sketchbook. I'll be joined by local musician Laura Zahasky and host and interviewer Pat Race. Again, that's January 8th at the Goldtown. Tickets and information at krnn.org and at the station.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 3rd of January, 2014. It was on this day, 1841, the whaling ship Acushnet sailed from New Bedford, Massachusetts. Young Herman Melville was on board. Whales, very valuable in that day, most valuable for their oil. Petroleum was not discovered until 1859 in Pennsylvania, and until then the oil from whale blubber was the most widely available fuel for lamps and streetlights and also a popular lubricant. Melville was part of the last generation of men who hunted whales by hand, drawing up close to the creature, stabbing it with harpoons, particularly the sperm whale, which could weigh up to 60 tons, grow up to 60 feet long, and who had been known to kill many men and to destroy whole ships during a whaling hunt. He experienced his first whaling hunt off the coast of Brazil, March 1841, and spent 4 years at sea and then spent much of the rest of his life writing about his experiences. It was on this day, 1882, Oscar Wilde docked in New York City, where customs asked him if he had anything to declare. He replied, "Nothing but my genius." He'd come to the United States for a lecture tour, something of a dandy, and many people thought he was ridiculous, but he got to meet Walt Whitman and Longfellow, and his lecture did very well in some places, such as the mining town of Leadville, Colorado. He was a big hit there. And it was there in Leadville Oscar Wilde saw a sign at the local saloon that said, "Please do not shoot the pianist. he is doing his best. It was on this day in 1521 Pope Leo X excommunicated Martin Luther for condemning the Catholic Church in his 95 Theses. It's the birthday of Cicero, Marcus Tullius Cicero, 106 B.C., born in Arpinium, Italy, who believed in the ideal of Rome as a republic at the very time that a series of powerful leaders were making it into an empire. And it's the birthday of Father Damien, born Joseph de Voister in Belgium, 1840, the priest who served the leper colony on the Hawaiian island Kalaupapa. And it's the birthday of the Danish poet and resistance fighter Morten Nielsen, born in Aalborg, Denmark, 1922, executed by the Gestapo in Copenhagen in 1944. Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, entitled Mindful. Every day I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these, the untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. A poem by Mary Oliver, Mindful, from her collection Why I Wake Early, published by Beacon Press, Boston, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to, thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is a welcome return to the show. Ben Huff is here. The last time I had a chance to do a lengthy interview with Ben, it was because he was just opening a really fabulous show about the Hall Road at the State Museum, and this had all been shot with a view camera. But he is now divulging his secrets. He's become the photo instructor out of the University of Alaska Southeast. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you very much for having me, Pat. Good to see you again.
So I hear you've got a couple of classes that are coming up that sound pretty interesting.
Yeah, we do. I'll be kind of taking over. Dave Gelada, a good friend of the community and a good photographer here in town, is heading for Point South, and I'm sort of taking over the reins out at UAS, and we'll be continuing the basic digital course, Art 222, and then the intermediate course, Art 393, in the semester, both of them beginning on Monday evenings, and then the intermediate class on Wednesday evenings.
So beginning and intermediate. Mm-hmm. Can we define a beginner and an intermediate photographer?
Absolutely. Both of them both classes will kind of start with a bit of history. So we all sort of have a common reference point to talk about art and something, or about photography, excuse me, and something that I think sometimes in classes is sort of missing is this sort of foundation, the same way that you would listen to Bach if you were in a music class and read Faulkner, or, you know, Mark Twain if you were in a writing class. We'll deal with some history in both, but for the most part, basic is the camera, how the camera works, what the functions of the camera are, how we use it in a manual setting, shutter speed and aperture and depth of field, and very nuts and bolts technical camera as a tool class. And then the intermediate class is really sort of this assumption that we have all of the technical bits nailed down. And it's this sort of melting pot of portfolio building and talking about bookmaking and dealing with digital printing and contemporary problems. I taught some special tapas courses there at UAS and at UAF, a bookmaking course and a printmaking course. And both of them kind of low attendance kind of classes. I have the opportunity with intermediate to kind of roll all of that together. And it's, I'm much more concerned in sort of viewpoint and voice and really working out sort of larger collections of photographs than I am kind of just based on the tool, which is really what the basic class is.
Ben, somewhere on your blog, you quote somebody, I can't remember who you were quoting at the time, who said that the least important component of photography, something I'm misquoting, is the camera.
Julius Shulman. Yeah, okay. That was just recently. He was still is probably the best known architectural photographer, and he came on sort of during the case study homes, sort of the beginning of modernism in architecture. And there's a wonderful, the name completely escaped me just now, there's a wonderful documentary on him that I had just watched the night before when I put that quote out. And he's absolutely right. I mean, and he is such a technically proficient photographer, but it sort of comes from this assumption that knowing the camera is just a given, and after that, it's about voice, and it's about viewpoint, and it's about passion, and it's about knowing your history and about knowing yourself. And that sounds like a lot, but the intermediate class is so much more sort of really kind of getting down to what the students want and how I can help them, you know, get that, to make those photos, to find that kind of sweet spot.
My question now, I don't want to undersell the basic course.
Please,
but
of course.
The basic course is so much about the technical side of the
thing. It is, yeah.
With all of the automation that's built into cameras today, how much do you need to know about what we used to call f-stops and shutter speeds and like that?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, you can put it on program or auto these days and click away and make sort of a technically perfect photograph. You know, you can make something that's sharp. You can make something that is exposed well. But a technically perfect photograph doesn't necessarily make a perfect picture, you know. And knowing how to make something that isn't just sort of satisfying the algorithm that the camera is set up. You know, the camera knows how to make a perfect picture in this light. But you looking at the light and knowing the night light and knowing the weather and knowing the direction you're pointing and knowing what it is you want to accomplish and knowing that the photo is infinitely so much better when it's done right in the camera and not in Photoshop after, and say, you know, I want to back this off a couple stops here or here I could make a perfectly pin sharp photograph, but I'd love to have a little bit of movement, and it not being perfect may make it perfect, which sounds really silly, enable you to sort of, again, take your voice and your creativity and what it is you want to do into the picture and make the camera work for you instead of, you know, putting it on auto and making, you know, you work for the camera.
So the class that you're offering is, you have beginning or basic digital
Correct.
Photography and intermediate digital photography. It sounds like if you... I guess the other question I meant to ask is, what kind of equipment are you expecting people to bring into these two classes?
Yeah, so a digital SLR is required for the basic course, and required for the intermediate course with a bit of a caveat. I want people to know, obviously, the cameras, and I don't want to spend a lot of technical time. We will some, but ideally not spend a lot of technical time in the intermediate class. But at the end of the day, the pictures that they're making, the cameras that they use, is of less importance to me. And if someone can make a really strong case to use something else, or if you're shooting film and you have means of scanning it and we can deal with it on the digital side and print on the digital side, absolutely. Give me a call, email me, and I'm happy to make those concessions.
So it sounds like the distinction between the classes is the Monday night class, which is at what time?
5:30 to 8:30.
5:30 to 8:30 on Monday night. The concept here is basically to fully come to the point where at the end of the semester you fully understand your camera.
And the software Photoshop. Yeah, the whole
right.
capture to the end physical
to the point where at the end of it we've got this thing out there.
Absolutely.
The intermediate class is more aimed at someone who has got a fair mastery of the camera, but is starting to wonder what it is that is going to turn them from a picture taker into a photographer.
Absolutely.
Did I get it close?
You nailed it, absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
Good enough. So Monday night, basic digital and intermediate digital on Wednesday night. These are Ben Huff's photo classes out at UAS. I think we're right on the verge of opening up registration again. The university's in a holiday until I think they open up Monday.
Yep, on Monday. Yeah. You'll have all of Monday of next week, and classes start on the 13th.
Right. So, and you want to be registered in this class. That Monday night class starts on the first one of those is on the
13th.
The 13th.
It is,
so,
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you don't want to miss any of these because you miss one, then you don't know what the button on the left hand side at the top does to the camera. Ben, thank you so much for bringing it to us and telling us about it.
Thank you, Pat. Good to see you again.
A little Manhattan transfer here as we prepare for our next guest. They're going to be doing a concert in May, and tickets are on sale now, and if I'm right about the way the tickets are going to sell for this one, you better get on it. Munache, Kunana Yatakanya, Ukanakaru, Yatakaru, made a Katau for Tapre, Hilda Nakara, Akasayan, Akasilva Nakanha, Hilda Tapre, Eston, Tavahi, Kunanaki of the Tedi, Ukanaki, Hanu.
The legend of hypothermia begins, as any Alaskan tale should, on a frozen landscape with wolves howling and a vast, dark, moonless sky of swirling northern lights above. It was on that long-ago night that a lone brewer stood against the harsh winds with only his beard to protect him and dreamt of a beer so full of hop flavor, so jam-packed with the spirit of frontier Alaska, it could freeze your very soul and one of your thumbs. All that winter, as moose, wolverines, and one beaver peered through his remote cabin window, he feverishly labored to make a beer that could face down the harsh elements, that could conquer not only thirst, but fear itself. After the thaw, the lone brewer had vanished, leaving behind only a few recipes scrawled on scraps of paper, a sock puppet, and a hand-whittled keg. In that keg, he left his legacy, hopothermia.
Oh, Okay, so let's get a couple of things straight here. One is, this is the only radio station in the world where you would hear something like that. And two is, this is the only radio station in the world where the guy who did it is sitting opposite
there
the
you
other
go.
Side of the thing. Andy Klein is here. And Andy used to basically run most of this radio operation here. When you,
just little bits and corners of it.
Oh, yeah, man, yeah. You were 36 hours a day, 9 days a week, I think, right. When you were here. Anyway, now he's moved over. He's joined the other side, and primarily because they give him free beer.
It's one of the reasons, yeah. I'm not denying it.
But that's the new Andy, who is now doing all of the public relations work and advance telling the story about the new beers in
yeah.
the Weston Brewery.
Thanks, Pat. Yeah, and that's one of the beers. That's one of our. We've got a really exciting month because we are releasing this new beer, Hopothermia. It's our first four-pack we've ever done. It's a beer that people in Juneau might be familiar with because it's been on Rough Draft for a couple of different years, but this is the first new year-round bottled beer we've done in over a year, so in about a year. So, Hopothermia, it's a double IPA, so it's a strong beer. It's about 8.5% alcohol content. That's one of the reasons why we're doing it as a four-pack, because it feels responsible to give people just four at a time. Go by. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I thought we'd taste a little bit of that here today. And then
this is the best part of being the Friday host on this program.
Absolutely.
Is this opportunity. And so, as always now, you're going to open the bottle so actually know what this beer sounds like.
We
can't see it on radio, so we have to know what it
is. You can't see it, but just so you know, it's got Nugget and Apollo hops are dry hopped in this, and then also Amarillo, Citra, and Centennial hops in this, so sort of a hop.
Here it comes, folks.
Scooch
up next to your speaker.
And we're going to open Hopothermia. Hold on. Here it goes.
The sound of one beer popping.
Yes. Let's just... Can we get that? A little bit of the pour there. Okay.
All right.
There's the pour.
Right.
That's for you. Ooh, over.
Here it is.
Ooh. Sorry. Jeff just about had a heart attack when I passed that over the board. Sorry. That's a party foul. But here you go, Jeff. Just going to have a little. We're having a little bit of Hopothermia here. There you go. All right. All right.
What's happening? Is there a party?
All right. We're on the air, John.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing Juneau Afternoon. Hopothermia, double IPA.
Delightful.
8.5%. Did you taste a little?
Absolutely delightful.
And
I had expected something like an IPA, you know, which bites a little bit. But
this thing's not a palate buster, though. It's got real balance. That's one of the hallmarks, as you know, of Alaskan brewing, that we're not interested in that busting the palate thing. We want to have a nice malt backbone and then also complementing the hops. So it's got a fairly healthy IBU, a bitterness level, but it's not one of those palate busters.
I went out on the website, and at the bottom of each of your beers, there's this little technical section that says OG, that's the gravity.
Yeah, original gravity.
1.054. And then ABV is the alcohol content.
Right.
5.3. Well, I'm actually reading ESP. But anyway, then there is this thing about the bitterness. And
right.
IBU. What,
right.
What's an IBU?
In some bitterness units.
Okay.
Sometimes it's in BUs.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Sometimes
and
it's
so
BUs.
And so the more of them there are, the higher the
right.
bitterness of the beer.
And there's some double IPAs out there and even IPAs that are in these, like, they're you know, 100 BUs range, right?
Yeah.
But there's a certain point where your palate, we feel like, and our brewers feel like, there's a certain point where your palate can only take so much. And really, what's the point of making it, you know, that high? And what you really want is a good, strong beer that can stand up to a lot of the foods that you want to eat along with this beer, but also just is a great drinking beer. So it's a beer that, as we say on the packaging, is to be respected. It's an 8.5% beer, so it's a good sipping beer.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quaff this beer. Sip it. But
unlike a pale ale,
or even the ESB,
yeah.
which is the next thing that we'll try.
This is a
double IPA, and in that, and it's a part of the beer sector that's really growing. Double IPAs is something that a lot of breweries are doing right now. Real famous one out there is Torpedo. People might have had Torpedo. That's considered a double IPA. There's other double IPAs out there. So anyway, that's ours, Hopothermia. Look for it.
Yeah.
It's in four packs. It's in a bright kind of lime green packaging, yellow green packaging.
Yeah.
Really, I think, and thanks so much for saying it earlier, really great packaging. Tana Peters is our graphic artist who does all that work for us, and she did an amazing job on this. So we're really excited about the packaging and excited about this beer.
And, of course, on the bottom of each bottle, there's a button you can push that will play the piece that
we'll
started
out
our interview with.
We're looking at that kind of packaging. We're thinking about putting that in.
All right,
let's open up the next thing.
Well,
it's
the
really
second
fun.
Thing is there's a real story here. This is a bring back.
Yes.
And there are some people out there who have been waiting for a while
yes.
for this to bring back. I mean, when did you take this off the market?
2008 was the
yeah.
last year that this was in a bottle. This is what we're talking about is the Alaskan ESB. A long time was called the Frontier Ale.
Mm-hmm.
And was an original fall seasonal that came out in 1989. And it's had a lot of different iterations, but it's also had a lot of recognition through the years. It's won 4 Great American Beer Festival medals, including 3 gold medals at the Great American Beer Festival. It's won a number of other international festivals, including the Burton-on-Trent International Festival, where they invented ESBs. They recognize Alaskan ESB as the best ESB in the world.
Ah. Now, this is an extra special bitter. That's
right.
What the ESB stands
right.
for. So I'm taking the IBUs on this are going to be higher than they are on most beers?
They're not.
No.
And that's a kind of a funny misnomer.
Okay.
A bitter is a type of British beer.
Okay.
It's just a type of beer. It's called a bitter. So if you go to a bar in England and say, I want a bitter, they'll serve you up an ale. Bitter got called that because compared to pale ales, when they were first brought around, they had a higher hop profile, so they had a little bit more bitterness to them.
Okay.
But they're not bitter, what we would today consider bitter beers. And that's a funny thing, and I'm glad you brought that up, because people sometimes think, oh, bitter, I don't want bitter. This is actually a very mellow and smooth beer, and we should do
open
an opening and taste it
yes,
right now.
We
so
need
that,
to open this beer.
There's another one. Oh, that was a good opening there.
Yeah.
You have to down that hypothermia in order to get a taste of this. Yeah. Here we go. And this one, is that one yours?
They're all clean.
They're all clean. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. So, Pat, this one's for you.
All right.
Give you a little. Make sure you
Thanks
grab
it. Thanks very
much. There you go.
Got it.
And this one's
He's
for me.
He's not here, so we can pass it over the board.
You want an ESB?
Maybe an ESB.
Little bit, John? A little bit there. Okay. This is kind of like when you sit on the couch at other talk shows, right? You're the previous guest, then you get to just sit in. And
I should mention
enjoy
that
the next guest.
We have 3/4 of the staff of KTOO
yeah, it's
here
funny
in the
how
radio
this room
studio
fills
right
up
now.
On these days when you're tasting beer.
It certainly
here.
Does.
Yeah, this one's lighter, much lighter. This is a 5.3% ABV,
mm-hmm.
lighter in the bitterness
ABV
units,
alcohol content,
yeah. Okay. Lighter in the bitterness, and really a very drinkable, smooth beer. It's comparable in some ways to our amber, but it is a little bit more bitter, kind of a richer beer, but very drinkable, very sessionable. This is a beer that we sell in 6-packs, you know.
Okay.
You can
yes. So you can
right,
yeah.
And even cases.
Okay. I guess my comment about this is I have a tendency not to be a great hop drinker,
mm-hmm.
and I'm much more comfortable with this beer. It's a little more mellow and a little bit smoother and just a wonderful return to a beer of the past that has had a great reputation for Alaskan brewery.
And as you said, especially here in Juneau, we have heard for years, the minute ESB went off the market, it went off the market for a number of reasons. One was that it went off the market at the same time that Alaskan Brewing brought onto market their IPA, their original IPA, which was a beer that had a higher hop profile, so it seemed like a redundant kind of beer. So bringing it back seasonally is perfect for us. This beer is only going to be available through March, so this is our spring, rotating spring seasonal, and it'll come through and it'll be gone in March when the summer ale comes
on. So if you love this stuff as much as other people do, then you might want to maybe put some down in
yes,
the cellar
that's
there
right.
with the wines.
Yeah,
right?
It'll keep for a little while, keep for a number of months.
It'll hold, yeah. Okay, so Hopothermia
right.
is now available and probably on draft around town kind of thing.
It's on draft and it's available in these 4-packs
okay.
Yeah, and then the one thing I wanted to mention that we've got a really fun thing that's happening next Friday. Join us for the Hopothermia pub crawl. We're going to start, a bunch of the brew crew are going to start at the Imperial at 7 o'clock, and we're going to go around to the Viking, the Hangar, and the Alaskan, and we're going to have fun prizes and maybe some sampling. sampling and maybe some sing-alongs and all kinds of stuff, and we'll be hearing that great audio,
totally
too.
Totally outstanding. as always, it's a delight having you among us. I appreciate your coming in and introducing the new stuff.
Thanks so much, Pat.
Yeah, okay. So you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, been your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Been my great joy and pleasure to bring you some wonderful guests and to sit here with Andy and enjoy this new beer. We are KTOO in Juneau. As I said, we broadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. And in Juneau, we're on GCI Cable, digital channel 871. KTOO.org is our website. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and thank you very much from listeners like you.